For some centuries now, political and economic power has been centered in the countries of Western and Central Europe. A war between these powers tended quickly to become a global conflict. And then in more recent decades, power was more widely distributed. We began to find the centers of power were outside of these traditional European nations, in the United States of America, in the Soviet Union, in China, in Japan. Today, a great international global war is more likely to arise over the Suez or over Kashmir than it is over the Sudetenland or the Tsar. That is perhaps why the great German détente of 1971 did not make the splash that it would have made in previous decades. Indeed, it was passed over with hardly a headline. In November of 1971, Willy Brandt, the Chancellor of the West German Republic, was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace. Brandt took a good deal of pleasure in the fact that in 1971 a German could be associated with peace, with the cause of peace. He had become the symbol these last several years of a new mood among the Germans in Eastern Europe, in Central Europe, for he had said that the reunification of Germany need not be the first order of business in European policy. He had brought about a rapprochement between most of the German groups so that the Bundesrat was willing and able to declare that the lands, the Polish lands east of the Oder-Neisse rivers were not part of the fatherland and need not be claimed in future negotiations. And he was an active instrument in the bringing about of a Soviet-Western accord on Berlin, which, though it did not pull down the wall, did in fact reduce the likelihood of there being further nuclear confrontations over traffic in and out of Berlin or the governance of the city. Germany did not threaten the world with a third round, as German policy had threatened the world in the immediate post-war years, and as German actions had threatened the world during most of the 20th century. Now, this should have been a profound change. We should have felt that a millennium was dawning. More than any other people on the face of this globe, the German people bear the onus for the tragedies which have infected our world during this century. And yet, hardly a comment was passed. A tribute to the fact that the centers of power no longer confront each other over Central Europe, or rather that Central Europe is no longer the fulcrum of world power. Indeed, when our own president reacted to these events in Central Europe, he spoke less in praise of Mr. Brandt and of the German people than he spoke in hope of Moscow and what he prayed would be a new mood of conciliation and cooperation, a willingness to negotiate, an end to brinkmanship in the Cold War. In press conference after press conference during the last year, President Nixon spoke hopefully of a new Russian mood. He underlined for us again and again what he expected out of the SALT talks, the strategic arms limitation talks, which were taking place in Vienna and in Helsinki. I hope that there would be an agreement about the further distribution of the anti-missile ballistic systems. He spoke of his hope for increased trade between East and West. And indeed, when Secretary of State Rogers made 2 days ago his final report to the news media on the year, he emphasized, as had the administration throughout the year, the possibilities of new arrangements with the Russians, the possibilities of cooperation and negotiation, and he ticked off as evidence, one, the accord over Berlin, 2, the possibility of some arrangement between the Warsaw Pact nations and the NATO countries on the limitation of standing armies in Europe, 3, the SALT talks then proceeding, and 4, the various trade agreements which Secretary of Commerce Maurice Stans had symbolically negotiated in Moscow in the fall. And so the question which Americans were forced to ask was whether, in fact, there was a new mood in our world, a new possibility of arrangement and accord between the East and the West. Or was the administration simply reflecting its own wish fulfillment? 1971 was a year of retreat and of retrenchment for the American people. We were pulling out of Vietnam. The numbers of our troops in Vietnam had been cut in half and almost in half again. We were cutting our troop commitments in Europe to NATO. We were cutting our fiscal commitments to foreign aid, to NATO, to the United Nations. We wanted to withdraw from what Americans had come to believe was an overextended policy of commitment throughout the world. We were troubled by our own financial problems, inflation, unemployment, the first unfortunate balance of trade in America's contemporary history. Americans were preoccupied with domestic and financial problems, and we were burdened by the tragedy of Vietnam. We wanted to pull back and to withdraw, and we wanted a sense that we were not leaving our allies behind, we were not leaving from necessary commitments throughout the world, that in fact there was a new mood in the world, that American policy in the 50s and 60s had accomplished its objectives, and that we could pull back and retrench and deal with our domestic problems in some confidence that a new mood of international enmity, or at least of international cooperation, had come into being. Now, the question that we must ask is whether, in fact, this was simply wishful thinking on the part of our government, an attempt to dress up our retreat from international commitments in the best dress that we could find for it, or whether, in fact, there was substance to this feeling. I'm afraid that though Russian belligerency and aggressiveness may have been switched off from the European continent, it was in full cry in the rest of the world. And that this new mood, which President Nixon and Secretary Rogers and others talked about, was more a product of their own imaginations of what they wanted to think the world was really like than what, in fact, Mr. Brezhnev and Mr. Kosygin, Mr. Pogorny, and the others who control in Moscow looked at the world and determined that it should be. But if the Soviet Union had truly wanted to bring an end to brinkmanship, to the Cold War, there were some very easy signals that it could have sent out to the world. The first was in the Middle East, the tinderbox, the place of confrontation. Now, the Soviet need not have withdrawn its political and economic support from Egypt. But the Soviet Union at the same time need not have spent the year, as in fact it spent it, doubling its military commitment to Egypt, doubling the number of soldiers and advisors that had been sent to Egypt, and changing their status from those of technicians to those of combatants. The Soviet Union could have simply replaced arms which the Egyptians needed instead of not only quantitatively but qualitatively stepping up the military confrontation in that part of the world, sending to Egypt new attack bombers, supersonic in their speed, new ground-to-air and ground-to-ground missiles, which that part of the world had not seen before. The Soviet Union throughout the year played an aggressive role in the Middle East, not only to secure the destroyer and submarine bases in near Alexandria and in Algeria, which had been secured in 1970, not only to secure its economic and political sway over the Arab world, but because it wanted to exploit every ounce of opportunity and advantage which American retreat political retreat, an economic retreat afforded it. And if you want to have some indication of the aggressive nature of the Soviet policy, look at it not so much vis-a-vis Israel, look at it, its policy among its own allies. During the year, Libya, Egypt, and the Sudan joined together in a collegium of nations, a confederation with a joint, supposedly a joint domestic and foreign policy. Their policy was directed against Israel. And one of the Soviet acts during the year was to sponsor and underwrite an attempted communist coup against Mr. Numieri, the leader of the Sudan. Though he was an ally, though he was engaged in actions which the Soviet applauded, but there was a chance to put their men in, and no chance was to have been left unturned. What was seen in the Near East could be seen also on the Indian subcontinent. During 1970 and 1971, the United States had been retrenching, sending less foreign aid and less military aid to Pakistan and to India. The Soviet Union's response in August of 1971 was to sign a 20-year friendship treaty with India, which in effect promised Mrs. Gandhi as much arm and a good deal of aid as she required. And the results of that treaty were very clear in November and December, when, encouraged by this active support, Mrs. Gandhi launched her troops against East Pakistan. And the Soviet Union in the Security Council precluded any kind of world resolution on ceasefire and withdrawal until the Pakistani troops in what is now Bangladesh had surrendered and the country was secured. The Soviet Union throughout our world during 1971 was expansion-minded, eager to exploit every advantage, quite conscious of the fact that though the United States remains economically the greatest power in the world, and though our military machine is still the most potent in the world, the American mood, in effect, hamstrung any kind of effective American response or commitment. The typical futile American response during 1971 was to sail an aircraft carrier and some destroyers into the Bay of Bengal during the Pakistani invasion, pointless. Never touched shore, they were not relevant to the problem. The Soviet Union was quite conscious that the world knew that America was pulling back and withdrawing and preoccupied, and she was eager and active in exploiting every possible advantage. Why was she cooperative in Europe and aggressive elsewhere? Because it suited her advantage, and that is, after all, the basis of policy of any state. France, over the last few years, Germany, over the last 2 years, have been trying to open windows to the east. There are trade arrangements to be made, sophisticated West European equipment for the things that the Soviet can produce. There is a certain leverage which can be gained through trade over the international policies of these nations. She recognizes that America is withdrawing material and manpower and financial support from NATO, and she wants to encourage this withdrawal. It will only in the long run redound to the strength of the Warsaw Pact nations. And she was eager to gain a breathing spell for the satellite countries who had suffered so much economically and otherwise during the last years. In the spring, you will recall, the government of Mr. Gromyko in Poland fell. Why? Because there were strikes among the dock workers, because the housewives demanded bread, a higher standard of living, more food. The satellites had been abused since the Second World War in order to build up Soviet military might. And there was a need for a breathing spell to raise the standard of living, to allow Mr. Gierek to come in, promising better times to his own citizens. And so what seems to be a mood of conciliation, a mood of cooperation, if we look about it from the old power center, from the European nexus, when we broaden our horizons and take in the whole world, seems to be this clear statement that far from being eager to nail down by negotiations the points of confrontation with the world, the Soviet Union is quite conscious of the fact that this is a moment, a time of advantage to her, and she will aggressively move wherever she can in order to take advantage of the opportunity. While 3,000 miles and more from the borders of the Soviet Union, Mrs. Bandaranaike and the Ceylon faced in the spring and summer of this year an attack from dissident student and leftist groups against her own leftist government. And the first government to be on hand with plane loads of supplies, with technical assistance, was that of the Soviet Union, who cooperated with her and helped her to put down this rebellion. Wherever there was advantage to be gained, the Soviet Union was there to pick up the leavings. The leavings that she picked up were of tremendous advantage to her, so that as the year ends, one must say that the era of American dominance, the era from the end of the Second World War through the middle of the 1960s, was finally nailed down and ended. And now there is at the very least, a parity of global power between the Soviet, the East, and America to the West. What does this mean for peace in our times? What does this mean for the peace of the world? I often thought during the year of the old Yemenite folk proverb among the Jews of that country called Shinui Shanui. Every change is a change. Every change is really makes things different, but really does not solve that much. There will be a different balance of power in the world. Our currency has been devalued. Other currencies have been revalued. Our power has been diminished. Other powers have been increased. Does that add to the possibilities of peace in the world, or does it subtract from the possibilities of peace? I do not know, but this much I know, that it ends once and for all the age of American innocence. Either the innocence that American power can authorize and demand that the world dance to its tune, that everything be arranged as we wish it to be arranged, or the reverse innocence of so many in America, that if America only becomes passive and peaceful and withdraws from its imperial ambitions, the world by itself will suddenly be rearranged into a peaceful community. The peace movement has gained this much of its objective, that it has hamstrung American policy from being aggressive, from being action-oriented. Though we have power, we cannot use this power. The national will at the moment will simply not support it. So what of the future? What does it mean? America is peace-loving for the moment. We have no other alternative. We mean what we say when we speak of peace. We would truly like to have arrangements with the Soviet, with other countries of the world. But will this bring peace? Or does it simply whet the appetite of the Soviet and of others? We do not know. But this much is certain, that the withdrawal of American policy, of American power, has left behind, cast up on the shore, many of our smaller allies, many of those who put their faith in the American system. Why is Israel in the position in which she finds herself? Early in the year, Mr. Sadat did signal to the world that he was willing to accept some kind of temporary accommodation with Israel. And he had behind him, when he made that signal, the assurance of the Soviet Union of supply, of manpower, of going to see to it that whatever agreements were arranged at, they would press for those agreements and more later on. And the American government tried to encourage Israel to make some kinds of concessions on her part, to withdraw, if not unilaterally, at least on the assumption that there would be some kind of peace paper. Israel proved adamant. And the world was very much disturbed by Israel's adamancy. Why does she hold on to this territory? What can she hope to gain And the American government tried time and again to slap the wrists of Israel, as if Israel was being a bad little boy standing out there and demanding its pound of flesh. Everything, territory, peace, everything on its own terms. Why couldn't Israel accept some temporary arrangement as Mr. Sadat seemed inclined to do? Because any temporary arrangement required the agreement of the big powers. The big powers had to say essentially each to their own client states, we will see to you that these temporary agreements do not harm your military position, your strategic position. We will see to it that you've not simply made concessions and that more concessions will be demanded of you and then again more. That something truly will be gained by this temporary interim agreement. The Soviet, active, aggressive, moving, committing itself in an era of commitment, was prepared to make such agreements with Egypt. The United States professed to make commitments to Israel, but the Israeli government had no reason to believe that America could act on any professions which she spoke. They remembered in September of 1970 how when the ceasefire had been arranged on the Suez Canal, with the agreement that there was to be no forward movement of troops and of equipment into the area after the ceasefire agreement. They remembered how the Soviet and the Egyptians had moved the SAM-2 and the SAM-3 missiles into the area after the ceasefire had been announced. And how America had been powerless to make any response because she couldn't make any active, aggressive political move. They looked on America's reactions to the India-Pakistan conflict. And they saw that not only did America perhaps have no immediate national interest involved, but she couldn't make any kind of active political move. The national spirit would not tolerate it. And so Israel knew, it was a cold-blooded calculation, that whatever professions the State Department might make, whatever commitments they would make, that if we pull back 20 miles from the canal and you allow certain advisors to come over and not other advisors to come over, and in fact military troops do cross the canal, we will see to it that economic military pressures are brought to force their withdrawal. It was a cold-blooded, careful calculation of the Israelis that America would not put itself into that position because American government was not in a position to act upon such commitments. At a time when powers are shackled and hamstrung, other nations cannot depend upon them. Oh yes, you can make agreements with the United States about the delivery of jets. You can count the jets as they come. But when it comes to the uncertainties of international arrangements, America at this moment in time cannot be depended on. What happened to CENTO and to SEATO? And what is the real power of NATO today? And what are American commitments to these treaties we embarked on just 15 years ago with so much éclat? Israel, I'm afraid, suffers a good bit because of this incapacity of America to display and to use its power in the world. But that's a fact of life to which she must adjust, and again, in the form of which she must determine her own policies. 1971 was then a year of American retrenchment, of Soviet expansion, of American defeat and Soviet success. And it was a year in which the shadow of China loomed over the Soviet sun. Because if there is one fact of life in the politics of our complex world, it is this, that no move by any major country but breeds a counter move, that no one is allowed for long to enjoy imperial success. England had it for most of the 19th century. America superseded England after the First and certainly after the Second World War. The Soviet has moved imperialistically since the Second World War. How long will she enjoy the fruits of her accomplishment? There's China. the largest, most populous country in the world, facing the Soviet along the long Siberian border. Much was made during the year of Mr. Nixon's impending trip to Peking, but that's not the real importance of China. It simply signals not that the United States has accepted China into the world, but that China has come into the world and is prepared to accept the excuse me, I am sorry of the United States for its past actions towards China. China is in the world because of ping pong. Recall our ping pong tourney, the group that went to Japan and then was invited by Chou Enlai to Peking, and how during the meetings with these ping pong experts, the invitation was extended. Well, ping pong is a favorite Chinese sport. They are the experts in ping pong. And when the Americans went into China, they quickly discovered that if the Chinese had not played rather easily with them, they would have been beaten even more severely than they were in fact beaten. China has allowed the United States to come into Peking, our president to come to Peking, on their terms. She forced the United States to allow the unseating of Taiwan in the United Nations, the seating of China not only in the United Nations but in the Security Council with the veto vote. She is not coming to Washington. Washington is coming to Peking. And Washington is coming as a suppliant, as one who for years tried to deny the existence of China, but who now must admit that the Chinese power is real. What will the Chinese gain from Mr. Nixon's presence? Something of a block between Washington and the government and Formosa. We will not be as willing and as eager to sponsor Formosan ambitions as we have been in the past, and perhaps that's to the good. But more than that, she is signaling to the Soviet world that she does not stand alone. Though she is quite prepared to meet the Soviet on any terms, she now has all kinds of political maneuverings available to her in the West, which she can use to bring military equipment, to bring financial power to bear on her struggle with the Soviet. Or whether it's in South Asia, over the balance between Pakistan and India, whether it's in the Middle East, over the sponsorship of radical Arab terrorist groups as opposed to the governments of the established states, whether it's in the central belt of African countries, where the Chinese have sponsored the more radical revolutionary groups, wherever it is in the world, the new Chinese power challenges the Soviet power and will demand of the Soviet their day of comeuppance, their day of accountancy. American retrenchment, Soviet expansion, the Chinese shadow, these are the basic terms, in my opinion, of the history of the last 12 months. The UN has shown itself again to be a futile institution, a useful, perhaps, debating society, but incapable of arranging ceasefires, of arranging treaties, of arranging cooperation between the nations. The nations will have to adjust to each other in traditional diplomatic and political terms, and God help us when the politicians and diplomats begin to engage in these kinds of undertakings. And there is in our world, even if we resolve the second tier of international confrontations, now that the first problem, the problem of Central Europe, seems to be temporarily resolved. Even if we resolve the Middle East, even if we diffuse the confrontation between India and Pakistan, even if China does not make good her threat to India, that she will see to India's comeuppance, there remain a whole series of very real festering problems, the hidden sores, the underdeveloped, the poor nations in the world. All across Central Africa, from the Congo, Chad, Cameroon, Uganda, Ethiopia, the Sudan, all across that belt of poverty and misery, the emerging nations of Africa. There were signs during 1971 of violence, tribal, international, internecine. In Chad, 15-year rebellion was being fought on. In the Cameroons, a Christian government was launching its troops against Muslim tribesmen to the north. In Uganda, the government of Mr. Obote was overthrown and replaced by a junta. In the Sudan, a Muslim central government was carrying out genocide against southern black tribesmen. In Ethiopia, the Christian government of Haile Selassie was being challenged by an independence-minded Eritrean Muslim group. There was poverty, and there was misery, and there was illiteracy, and there was violence, all the festering sores which make for the intrusion of foreign ideologies and the intrusion of foreign governments and the tensions of our world. And throughout Latin America, there was violence and kidnapping, the Tupamaros. There was the election of the first communist government in Latin America, in Chile, Mr. Allende's government. There were clear indications in most of the countries of Latin America could not cope with the problems of the population explosion, the needs of their cities, the needs of coming to grips with the technological age. There were problems aplenty in our world, and there was very little evidence of the big powers cooperating to meet these problems. Kol Shinui Shanui. Every change is a change. The age of innocence, the age when any of us can look for simple adjustments between major power blocks or through the United Nations to the problems of our world, seem to me to be behind us. We are back in a world where the small powers and the larger powers and the superpowers are all grabbing for what they can, responding to priorities and the urgencies of their own society. It's a world of complexity, not a simplicity. It's a world which requires seichel, hard common sense, and not ideology. It's a world which is going to be filled with headaches and heartaches for as long as we can look ahead. And if man has the capacity, which men have not hitherto shown, to be patient, to work hard, to sacrifice for peace, to work to undo privilege, to work to accomplish that which can be done at the moment, to avoid the simplicities, the ideologies, the complete answers in one sentence which the demagogues and leaders of our world tend to offer us. If men are willing to get down to the hard business of solving the problems of the world, domestic and international, if they're willing to dedicate their lives sacrificially to that cause, then perhaps many of these problems will have their solution. If not, there's going to be bloodshed. And God knows we had our share of bloodshed during 1971. And there will be violence, and there will be secession, and there will be revolution, and there will be confrontation. It's not a pleasing prospect. But then when has our world been really a pleasing place? Life always demands the most of us, the utmost of our understanding and the utmost of our strength. And our world certainly demands that kind of commitment from each of us.